and the facility transfer tax bill. We are about 5 minutes late, which is not a good thing, but presence beyond our control has forced us to. Welcome, Keith and Frank. I don't know how you're going to do this, but the floor is yours.
Okay, Chairman, we'll begin. You can decide whether you want to stop at, you know, at what point you want to stop and ask questions. We can do an appropriate breaking point, so we can wait till the end, either way you'd like.
When members feel saturated, they'll raise their hands and we'll stop. We're joking. But, you can just run through as we've, as is normally the situation.
Okay, that's fine. Let's see here. Let me just go just a little bit of background here. This is the second, every year it seems the tradition has become that we have two taxation laws amendment bills. We have a taxation laws amendment bill in the first half of the year for the rates and all of that, usually the simpler matters, the quick stuff. And the second half of the year is the heavy lifting. And that's all the complex issues and all the stuff that we're dealing with here. That seems to be the tradition. It'll be nice one day when we can get it all into one bill. But procedurally, that makes it a little difficult, but we are trying to work toward that goal. The main thing in this bill is the STC issues, dividend tax issues. Now, it's important before we talk about the issues that are before us is that we announced in the budget a trade-off, that we were going to close the loopholes, broaden the base, and lower the rate. In the comments that you've heard, you haven't heard anybody thanking us for lowering the rate. You just heard the complaints about broadening the base. So there is a trade-off here, and the price of having a lower rate is a broadened base. And again, that's consistent with what our minister has done elsewhere, capital gains tax, other areas, that if everybody pays their fair share, we all can pay a reasonable share. If some of us don't pay our fair share, well, then others have to pick up the slack. So this is very consistent with that. In this bill, we have two sets of revenue laws amendment bills. The biggest discussion will be around the substantive issues, the policy issues. There are some administrative issues, the second bill. There's also the securities transfer tax bill. But there you didn't see very much comment, so that's been pretty much accepted as is. There might be one or two comments toward the end, but mostly this is about the revenue laws amendment bill. Let me just also close about the process. We managed this year to get our bill out about a month earlier, and we came to you in the committee in late September. Normally, we come for the first time in mid-October. What that meant was that we had a month of comment time, which I think was actually useful. We did two things. One, we've had an extended period of comment for us, and then two, we had a media release. And between that, we generated a lot of comment this year. We have about over 60 submissions. Normally, we're dealing with 20 to 25. So it shows you that if we have more time and we try to create the process and extend it some, that we can get a better set of responses. The document here today is dealing with those comments. And what we've done is we try to bring forth conceptually all the big issues. We're not dealing with all the typos and minor stuff. What we really are trying to deal with all the stuff that you as a committee are really interested in. Now, when we look at the comments, I must say that they were fairly useful. I think the comment process for us is fairly worthwhile. And you'll see that we made a lot of accommodations in this. We tried to accommodate wherever we could. There were places where we couldn't. But you will see that I think on the average we were as accommodating as we could be. So you'll decide that for yourself. But I think that's our general view on things, that we get comments, we try to accommodate them where possible as long as the policy is not undermined. Now, what we'll do today is we'll go back and forth between Franz and myself so you don't get too tired of my voice, and we'll proceed from there. If you turn to page 2, you'll just see an outline of the issues, just to give you a sense of where we're going. And what you will see here in this is the bulk of the issues lie in items 1 through 4, which is STC base broadening, group of company relief, company reorg, capital versus ordinary shares, and then actually 5, intellectual property. That's where all the sparks have gone to. That's where the big money is. So that's just trying to let you know with a sense of which way we're going. Now, before we go through the comments, because this gets a little bit esoteric, I just wanted to remind you where we're at here. You'll find that a lot of this stuff is fairly esoteric, but we're talking about big money at stake. What we're basically talking about here, and I just got it on the slides, just some quick slides, and I've shown them to you before when we did our initial presentation. I just pulled out the relevant ones, is that what we're talking about primarily is games around the SPC, games around distributions. That's really what's going on here. And I'll just say there are basically two big slides that we need to deal with. And one is sort of dividend stripping, and another one is disguised sales, contributions. So let me just go to this one first. And let me try to explain this in a very plain way, and then we can get a little more technical. Normally, if you sell a business, you would expect to be taxed. Now, if you go to your lawyer and you say, look, I'm a company and I want to sell my subsidiary, and I have lots of profit I've made and I'm going to sell away, the first piece of advice lawyer number one will tell you is, well, you have a capital gains tax on average, and you've got to pay a 15% rate. So that's what you hear. And then you say, well, do I really want to pay that tax? Well, see what I can do. You go to lawyer number two, maybe one of these guys over here. And they say, well, you know, I think we can get you 10%. So, okay, you can take the 15%, get it down to 10%. You say, well, this second lawyer is a lot better, until you meet lawyer number three. Lawyer number three says, you know something? You don't really have to pay any tax at all. She says, ooh, I like this guy. So you then move yourself to number three. And then before you know it, you get lawyer number four or account number four who says, you know something, not only can I make sure that you pay no tax on this transaction, but I can actually generate losses for you so that you don't have to pay taxes into the indefinite future. That sounds pretty good. And the question is, where's the joke? Well, the joke is on us, because we end up losing that revenue. And that means that we don't have the resources to do the expenditures that you want to do, or it might mean that our minister is not able to grant the PIT relief that we're looking for in February. So this is really what is before us. And a lot of these transactions at stake are quite a concern. Now, in all fairness to the people who made presentations here, I think that the presentations here were quite honest. I think that people admitted, they said, look, you know, we knew this was going on, and, you know, we understand that. And I don't think anybody that has come before us has really defended the indefensible. And so they understand that this is what was going on, and that in the future they won't be able to do these maneuvers anymore. Not to say that other maneuvers won't take place, and not to say that we won't be back here again just dealing with different transactions. So the game goes on. But that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about when you sell a business, avoiding all tax altogether, and if you're smart, actually generating artificial losses along the way. Now, the stuff here that we talk about is very, you know, professorial, high-level, boxes, all the stuff that people like myself and Franz so love on a daily basis. But to the average man on the street, it's not so accessible. We get worked up about the taxi driver who doesn't pay his tax, but I'm telling you, the money here is in the hundreds of millions, if not the billions. It may not be exciting to look at, but it is very important. And what we're dealing with today is specifically these kinds of transactions. Now, basically, the deal we're talking about in a simple form, there's variations on all of this, is that in the structure I gave you here, you have a target company, i.e. a company you want to sell, and you can sell it. And as I said, you can pay a 15% capital gains tax. But you don't want to do that because your second lawyer has already told you, well, why pay a 15% if I'm a company selling if I can get a dividend instead? And a dividend gets you a 10% rate under the new system. So that's not too bad because we kind of know there's a little bit of a split there. Now, why does that happen? When you buy a company grows. That company growth, the money can come out one of two ways. You can sell the company, and make a profit because it's grown and it's much bigger than it once was. So if you pay $100 million for a company and you sell that company for $1 billion, well, you've got $900 million of profit and you sell it and life goes on. If you decide instead to take the money out not by selling, but by getting a dividend out of the company, so you can sell it and get your $1 billion from someone else, or the $1 billion that's in the company, you can just take out $900 million out of the company. And if it's a dividend, there will be an SPC of 10%. There is a differential there. Okay? That's option two. Where you get a little smarter is the taxpayer says, well, why do I want to pay the 10%? Well, instead of taking the money out via dividend, what I will try to do is take it out as tax-free dividend, which is the second slide, where there are various ways of taking out a tax-free dividend, which we'll come back to. Or, going back to the first slide, you don't call it a dividend, you call it a capital distribution. A dividend comes out with a 10% tax. Something called a capital distribution comes out with no tax. So what do you choose? You choose the no tax. That's the way it's done. So that's the second one. Then, if you're smart about it, when you sell, you try to strip so much value out of the company that you generate a loss. And that's, again, this slide here. So I'm going to kind of go back and forth with these two slides so you'll see them a little bit more. But we're really talking about, instead of selling a company, pulling the money out of the company beforehand and then selling. You strip the value before you sell. Now, you strip value, if you're smart, that you got indirectly from the other guy. Because if you could just take out the value any time, it wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't need the other guy. The problem is you need the other person's money. So that guy has to stuff the money into your company so you can take it out. That's one variation of the theme. And I'm being very simplistic here, but just to get down to the point of it, so it isn't quite as esoteric. But again, we're talking about big money. Let me just then begin on the comments here. Now, as I said, if you look at most of the comments, they accept that this really is not the way forward. And I think everybody was very honest, and I think the comments were very useful. And as I said, the question is the game. What we have here is I just want to go through the comments, where we accepted, where we didn't accept. And I think the biggest issues when we're talking about the SEC is about something called retrospectivity, whether we're being retroactive or not. And some cases we agree with the taxpayer that maybe we've been a little rough, and maybe we will make accommodations, and other times, well, we're less accommodating, but we'll take them one step at a time. Let's turn to page two, just about pre-2001 capital profits, pre-93 profits. The way the system works is that if you have profits, and the big one is the pre-2001 profits, prior to 2001, capital profits could be pulled out tax-free. Is that?
On liquidation.
On liquidation, thank you. That's why we need him. On liquidation. If you pulled it out as an ordinary dividend, it wouldn't work. If you pulled it out as redemption, it couldn't work. You can make it work. That regime existed as sort of an administrative rough justice because at that time we didn't have capital. We had a capital ordinary distinction. We reduced that distinction. And so as of 2001, we said, going forward, all capital profits arising after 2001 will not get this benefit anymore. It's only pre-2001 capital profits that have a prior exemption. That's what's going on. The proposal in our legislation is to repeal this going back. Now, we're not really going back here because we're talking about liquidations going forward. But the big issue is that, oh, I built up all of these gains beforehand. The triggering event may be later, but historically this built up beforehand. Now, so they're arguing that even though we're taxing going forward, it has a retrospective element. So this is sort of the edges of what is retrospectivity. We're talking about events going forward, and we're saying that, no, we're not going to give relief for that. You still have time to pull those profits out. But as administration, it's a question of administration. We are not going to protect your built-in appreciation, so to speak. We've done that in some cases, not others. We don't believe what we're doing is retrospective. We sometimes do grant concessions in this area, but frankly, this creates a lot of administrative difficulty for us. Because now when you have a liquidation going forward, you've got to figure out what's post-2001 2001 profits, with pre-2000 profits. This kind of allocation is extremely complicated to do. And there comes a point where we have to start moving to hard cutoffs. Now, taxpayers like hard cutoffs when it works in their favor. Sometimes it works against them. And that's why here, we're giving them a delayed effective date for January 2009. But there's also something else going on here, which we are working on. And in the budget, we announced a discussion around fixing the base. What we're doing now is doing some closing of the loopholes. We are going to be fixing the base more comprehensively. One of the things we want to move away from is profit tracing. Profit tracing is where a lot of problems happen. It becomes unadministrable. So this is what that's all about, and we stick to our comment that we're not being retrospectivity. Sometimes we give relief, sometimes we don't here, but administratively it's impossible. I think this is one of the few places where we have not accepted the taxpayer comment.
Mr. Chairman, can I?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, the two hands. I'm not too sure which one came up first.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair.
I'm coming.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to make sure. In other words, the whole issue of retrospectivity is not going back on something that has happened already. It is moving forward, but it has got an effect on profits pre-2001 in terms of what is going to happen in the future. It is not something that is going to be applied on a liquidation that is already in the process. It's just something that's going to happen in the future, but it will have an effect on profits pre-2001. Because the one thing that people might say is that, you know, retrospectivity is because companies get penalized because they were smarter than anticipated. And obviously one must make sure that companies doesn't get, or business doesn't get penalized because they have acted within the law in the past, and that retrospectivity penalizes them on being law-abiding, but obviously using what the law and the acts provided. That was the one.
Yeah, I think your question has been addressed. We actually haven't reached the question time, but I just wanted you, I mean, you wanted to clarify so that as we move forward, you understand what exactly this retrospectivity impacts on. Mr. Mgun.
Yeah, my question was more of the same question, just to see, make it more simpler for me to understand. Does it mean that if the company then was takes obtain tax as normally, you know, pre-2001, and then in future, when go about the retrospectivity, if the company is going to be liquidated in the future, do you take those profits made prior to 2001 into consideration?
I'm not a computer expert here. I usually have somebody else handle this for me. Let me just say about retrospectivity, because I'm glad we're raising this now, is that there are different things of what you can argue is retrospective. Now, clearly, if I did something in the past, if I had a liquidation in the past, then I'm going to tax that liquidation. Then you start arguing that is the bigger issue. You know, so it was tax-free, say, 1998, and now you're going to make it taxable now. You go, oh, it was tax-free in 98, what you did, and so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back to 98 and make it taxable. That's the first case of retroactivity. So when we're talking about it, the question is, what is the triggering event? In this case, you have a liquidation, and what we're saying is liquidations in the future don't get the benefit of this pre-2001 buildup. So almost let me try to say with a driver's test. You go, you can take your driver's test, right? They change the rules. So you're studying for your driver's test now, and then all of a sudden it says, oh, all the rules have changed. Next month you have a different driver's test. You say, well, I've studied this test A, all along, and now I have to be prepared for test B in November. Now, have we done something retroactivity? Well, we're not going back and re-grading your exam. We're just saying, well, you've got to re-prepare for the exam going forward. So the point is that the testing event, clear retroactivity, deals with the issue of what that triggering event is. Then you get to some more subtle things. Well, I did the liquidation going forward, but I sort of assumed that if I did it go forward, that in the past I had a benefit. Do I get that anymore? And I think those are much closer issues. And frankly, I don't know if you have a constitutional case in that in argument. As a general matter, we try to give relief, but you know, to some extent, you can't give relief forever, because then what you find is the code becomes completely unadministrable. So a lot of times we do something favorable for the taxpayer, and sometimes you say, well, your days are limited. Here we've given you still a year and a half to unwind. So we're letting you know a year and a half, do whatever you got to do. Some people will be better than others, but people will be able to restructure to a fair amount to deal with this issue. And there comes a point where we can't minister 5 different or 10 or 30 different systems at once. So that's what we're talking about here. Then there's another form of retroactivity that some people have argued. I've entered into the contract today. So I enter into a deal today with the bank, and my deal says I've entered into this deal with you based on the tax laws in 2007. And that's the deal I've made. And then government comes in 2010 and changes the law. There's some people say, look, I entered into the contract in 2007, and even though that contract has an effect 30 years going forward, the tax law has to be frozen for the next 30 years, because I'm frozen by my contract. Now, that form of retro is not retrospectivity either, because we're saying, look, we have a right to change the law going forward. You might have had a contract, but you can't expect us to hold up our laws for 30 years for your contract to play itself out. And some people have argued, we have to respect the contract for the next 30 years. Now, what they're really asking for is something called fiscal stability. No tax system grants that kind of relief. You've got to be able to move forward. And as a matter of fact, banks are quite smart. When they enter into a deal with you on financing, they say, should the tax laws change, trust us, you will pay the difference. And that's how they work it out. But they know that the tax laws change as they go along. So there's different forms of retrospectivity. But the one we're talking about here on liquidations is, if you have a liquidation going forward, you will no longer get the relief of this pre-2001 profit buildup on the administrative round. But we're giving you a year and a half time. Again, we're trying to change the system more comprehensively, which we'll come back to later on. So again, I'm sure there'll be more on this. One thing we're trying to do more is trying to put effective dates into the bill sooner. And what you'll see why there's so much issues around here is that people say, fine, we accept the new law, just make sure it doesn't apply to me. Whatever I've done should be okay, right? Let everybody else take the hit. That's why these issues become very important, and I have a feeling you'll hear more and more of them as we go along. Part of the sophistication in the tax system. Anyway, I've gone on too much about that. We turn to page 3. There was some question about realized and unrealized profits. A taxable dividend comes out of profits. What is a profit? Is that something that you earn every year? Or what about the piece of land that you buy for $100 that grows in value to $1 million? Well, that's unrealized profit, because you have that profit, you know the land is worth a lot more than it once was, and now you try to take out a dividend based on that growth in value. We're saying that is fully taxable as well, because that's economic growth. People have complained that's not administrable, but frankly, I think the concerns about administration are overstated. One is, if you're going to be taking out your dividends out of unrealized profits, most likely you're going to have to borrow against it if you're going to be taking out substantial amounts. And if you borrow against it, the bank is going to do your valuation. So that's where you're going to get the cash. The second thing of all is, most dividends in the ordinary course, you've got more than enough profits on hand. You'll know it's a dividend. It's only the unusual dividend that will create the administrative effort of figuring out what's unrealized or unrealized. And it's the unusual dividend that's been given rise to the concerns that we've had in this bill. So there we don't accept either. Here we've been a little bit tough, but then you'll start seeing we get a little nicer as we go. A big issue that's come up, though, is around page 3 on this thing called share capital and share premium, allocation of share capital and share premium. Now, around there's questions about how we allocate. So if I have two classes, if I have preferred shares, with share capital of 100, and then I have ordinary shares with a capital of 1,000. The question is, how do you allocate? The company has lots of share capital. How do you allocate per class? In our original bill, we had an allocation based on market value. And we did this market valuation because we thought it was administratively easier. But the tax comments that have come back have universally said, please do the allocation according to our factual contributions. That's easier and more realistic. That has always been our preferred goal. We just didn't know whether it was administratively doable. So the taxpayer's comments in this regard are fully accepted. That to the extent that you receive cash for a certain class of shares, the share capital will be allocated according to that cash contribution. You don't have this fair market value allocation, and I think taxpayers were very concerned about this one, and so there we agree with the taxpayers. Now we're turning to page 4, and let me just come back to the slides for a minute. And this is down to paragraph 76 and 76 cap A. This is where the biggest issue is. This is where the deal comes down to, effectively, and that's what I have on the board. As I said to you, the seller can sell the target company. Let us assume the target company is worth 1 billion rand. Let us assume they paid only 100 million for the target company, so they're going to generate 900 million of profit. You could sell and be taxed, or what can happen is the purchaser can make a contribution to the target company of 1 billion rand. So they could pay you directly a billion, or they can put the 1 billion into the company. Well, they don't care because they're going to pay a billion anyway. So you say, don't put it into my pocketbook, put it into the company. So the seller puts it into the company, and then the next day, the seller takes it out as something called a capital distribution. Because the money represents not growth per se, but a contribution. Now, it does really represent growth, because the reason you got the contribution was because the company grew in value. But because of the weaknesses in the law, you pulled it out as a capital distribution, and you weren't subject to FTC, because it wasn't a dividend. And second of all, we had a weakness in our capital distribution rules. Our capital distribution rules allowed you to defer gain indefinitely. You said, okay, the company might have been worth 100 million, but if you pull out a billion, the 900 million can be deferred until you get rid of the shares in the target company. And we allowed basically a permanent deferral, and we did this on administrative grounds. We had a lot of reasons for this. We were trying administrative simplicity. There's a whole bunch of reasons why we were trying to grant this relief. But here was a case people said, oh, you need to give us that much? We decided to take advantage. And what they basically did was they stripped out all the value out of the company, or the money that they got in, without any immediate tax, and then they worked it out so that they didn't ever have to sell the shares, so that there would be no gain ever realized. There was a lot of deals on this. Taxpayers were quite honest here. They said, yeah, we shouldn't be allowed to do that going forward. They know that of all the 60 comments we received, nobody defended this practice, except for one, but I won't mention their name. They're not here today, so they don't have to feel guilty. The group here was very honest, and we appreciate that. But the biggest issue was, what happened in the past? Billions of money went out that should have been taxed. We're talking billions here. Could be wrong, maybe it's just 100 million. But from what I'm hearing, it's billions. What they're saying is, well, whatever we got away with, it's fine. Let us get away with it in the future. And we're not quite comfortable with that. That's a lot of money at stake here, and the question is, do we let it go? Now, the original legislation was designed to allow deferral. That if you pulled out a capital distribution with excessive amounts and you had a gain on that capital distribution, you were supposed to trigger gain when you sold those shares. But when we gave that relief, we assumed that the shares would eventually be sold. Now, they worked it out so they'll never have to be sold. And they're saying, well, please freeze this forever. That is the issue that's before us. Do we allow them to freeze it forever? The transaction has already taken place, but on an expectation that we would get gain in the future. Now, what we've done in the legislation, the original batch, was said that we will trigger this gain as of July 2008. problem was is that there were a lot of innocent taxpayers here, and a lot of capital distributions are done with good intent, and so they would also be triggered as well. So what we've done in the legislation is we've shifted the effective date from July 2008 to July 2011. So that if you've managed to game the system, we will let you have a 3-year deferral before we trigger tax. Now the reasoning that was behind this was to say, look, the normal taxpayer is going to sell his shares in the ordinary course. So we almost have it like a sift, you know, when you're sifting food in the kitchen and you're trying to get out all the bad elements. We're trying to let all the good people go, and over the 3-year period, we figure the guys who got their capital distributions in the normal course will shake themselves out. But the guys who are planning never to sell will hopefully be left in the so-called kitchen dish, or whatever it is, a coriander, I think it's called. And at that point, we can then take a good hard look at them. And that's, so we've made a concession here of a 3-year delay. I'm sure the taxpayers will come back on this issue a few times. But at this point, we wanted to make sure that the innocent go free. This was our rough justice way of accomplishing that. So there has been some fair amount of relief here. But the goal is to make sure that the gain that is due us will eventually come due. And there is big money at stake here. Go ahead.
Add whatever you need. Can I just ask, on that,
on
that date of 2011, was that just taken from the air, or was there some substance why you agreed, or, you know, proposing 2011? There were a couple of options here. I mean, one of them was to, let me take a step back. One of your big issues here is cash flow, obviously. Because you've got the money up front, okay, and you may have applied that money somewhere else, okay. So the question then becomes, was 6 months sufficient for you also to get your cash flow planning right? Now, for many people, it would have been. Now, having said that, we were then proceeding on the basis that 6 months is too little, because we do have the issue of people who are going to be caught up in this, who didn't anticipate it. And as Keith has mentioned, some of the amounts are very, very big and are currently tied up in non-liquid situations. So we had a couple of options. One was to, in fact, phase this in over time. In other words, to say, okay, on the 1st of July, we trigger a percentage of the gain, and then a year later, we trigger a further percentage, and that then would give relief on a cash flow basis. That has its own complexities. And so we decided that the 3 year additional period would be of the most assistance. Okay. Why 3 years? If you have a look at it, one of the tests we will be discussing later on is the cutoff between, and there we've used the 3 year period as well. So 3 years was something that sort of fitted in with the rest of the legislative scheme. And it seemed a reasonable period as well, even for very large sums of money to be planned for, to be paid over to the fisc.
Okay, now I'm going to ask members to hold on to questions. No matter how small they are, that would deal with the questions at the end of the presentation. Because, you know, there might be more members that are noting their questions on particular areas and not asking them. We might find ourselves bogged in one area and not making progress. So let's deal with the questions at the end. Proceed.
Okay. Just the next one here is, and some of these I realize we're going a little slow, but some of the stuff is heavy-duty stuff. If you take a look at the bottom of page 5, you see something called dividend stripping. It's at the bottom of page 5. And what happens in a dividend stripping transaction is that, again, instead of pulling the money out as a tax-free capital distribution or a tax-deferred capital distribution, you take your money out as a dividend, and then you sell. Now, what will happen then, oftentimes, is that you do a dividend first, strip the value of the company, and then sell at a loss. So you buy the company, say, for $800 million, it grows to $1 billion, and then before you sell, you pull out $800 million. So bottom line is you pull up the bulk of the value, you pull out value that you even had before you began, and the way it would work is by pulling out so much value, you've taken the money out of the company, but the tax law doesn't adjust something called its base cost,
for tax. So if you bought, say, the company for $800 million, you strip out the value via dividend. So the company's only worth $100 million. Your cost for tax purposes is still $800 million. And then you can generate a $700 million loss. I kind of have an example here. But the target company is $100 million. The tax bearer is a 75 base cost. That's what he purchased it for. And then he pulls out a huge dividend, so the company is not worth very much, and you sell at a loss. So they call that a dividend stripping transaction. And we did have a rule that went after dividend stripping, but it was insufficient. Now, the proposal we had is that if you have a dividend 2 years before sale, that not only were we going to go after the loss, but we were going to add to your gain. And after a lot of discussion, the taxpayer said, look, we feel that the rule, we understand why you're worried about dividend stripping, but really you're worried about is the loss here. The fact that we create excess gain, that seems a little harsh to us, and that what we would request is that the rule be limited solely to prevent artificial losses. And here, after a lot of discussion, we agreed with the taxpayers that we will limit the rule as they suggest, and we will deny the loss, but we will not trigger additional gain. And we'll see where that takes us. But there's a number of balancing factors, so I think taxpayers will be pleased with that one. Then turning over to page 6, again, another variation on the same thing. The way the deal works, if you really want to make it work, is that the dividend should generally be tax-free or has already been subject to FTC. So it's either tax-free or tax-deferred. Now, one set of deals is done where you get something called group relief on dividends, so that you basically get an exempt dividend. So say that, for instance, the target company is wholly owned by a 100% seller. So the seller owns 100% of the target company, and it gets the dividend beforehand. In that regime, you get a dividend that is tax-free. But it's not really tax-free, it's tax-deferred. Because the dividend that goes from the target company to the selling company should eventually be taxed when the dividend is later declared onward. So we have rules that are designed to say dividends are tax-free as long as we eventually get the tax. It turns out that there's a bit of a problem, as we said, that oftentimes that a dividend will not be tax-deferred because the money that goes up is not added to the shareholder's profits. And we put in a rule that said if the seller gets a dividend that's not added to its profits, they're not going to get group relief. Because we're only going to give you exemption if we know the tax will occur later on down the chain. Some taxpayers said that was excessive because we're triggering immediate gain there. And oftentimes the accounting rules are such that you get a dividend for tax purposes, but it's not a dividend for accounting purposes. Now, you'll see that just one of the games that people play is it's a labeling game. You tell the accountants what they want to hear, you tell the lawyers what they want to hear, and you work out the difference to your advantage. What we've said is, if for accounting, this is not a dividend, we will not treat it as a dividend. By not treating it as a dividend, we will now treat it as a capital distribution. So what's happened in the original proposal, we said, if for accounting, the money you receive...
Ms. Jones said, if you're not treating it as a dividend, you're treating it as capital distribution.
Let me restate. What was going on before, there was an arbitrage game. What was happening is, the seller was getting something that the tax law called a dividend, but that the accounting law said was a reduction of investment. And we said in that situation, if you're gaining us, we will trigger immediate taxation there. Because if you play that game, you're basically not going to get just the benefit of deferral, but you're going to get outright exemption. Now, let's just talk about this wish of deferral. The tax system is designed to allow you to roll over gains. Rollover taxes. The taxes should be deferred, but not exempted as a general matter. What taxpayers have done is they turn deferrals into exemptions. That's really what's happened. And the gain that we're talking about here is something that's called a dividend for tax purposes is called a reduction of investment for accounting purposes. In our original proposal, we said if that occurs, we will tax you immediately. Taxpayers said that was excessive. We will make a concession here and say, fine, if that situation arises, we will not call this a dividend but a capital distribution. By recharacterizing the transaction, we will basically convert your proposed exemption to deferral. So we won't tax you immediately. We will give the relief the taxpayers want, but we will make sure that we pick up the tax eventually. And that's essentially what the proposal does here. Now, there was one company that was very concerned about this. There was actually a few companies that were very concerned about this. We've interacted with them. They felt that the modification that we made was more than acceptable, and we move on. Of course, some people always wanted more, but at the end of the day, that the people who are leading the charge said this is a very reasonable way to go. So I think that solves that problem. Let's see here. Let me stop to give people a little break. And so let's let Franz take a little bit on group relief here, if he should so wish, or I can pass it back to me. Okay, he's telling me that he likes to hear my voice just a little bit more. So hopefully you can enjoy. Again, I'm trying to talk a little slower, but again, as a New Yorker, it's sometimes hard for me. Okay, group of companies relief. Okay, that's one big thing. Frankly, that first set of stuff is huge. That's where the big money is. Not exciting stuff, but important stuff. The second is around the group of companies definition. Now, that's where the third slide is. Now, just to get to the concept, a group of companies is basically parent owns all of sub 1, parent owns all of sub 2, maybe parent owns 100 other companies. This happens a lot in the world of commercial business. What happens is you can have one company, but you have the problem is limited liability. We create companies to limit our liability. So if sub 1 is in the business of candy and sub 2 is in the business of toxic waste, you put sub 2 in a separate subsidiary, so if any lawsuits arise out of sub 2, they're trapped in sub 2. So the point is typically just good commercial practice is to create many companies. But that limits your liability, but as a practical matter, the taxpayer controls everything. So you want to treat this group as one economic entity. And around the world, you see a lot of concessions for group relief. And we have a growing number of exceptions. Some discussions should be more, but we've moved a fair amount in this area. This area is quite complex, but what we've done to some extent is we said assets can move around the group tax-free, so parent can sell to sub 2, sub 1 can sell to sub 2, and the assets can move around, and any gain is deferred until those assets leave the group. Remember, we don't give exemption. We let you do what you do, but you have to pick up the gain at some time, so when you leave the group. Or if the group breaks apart, then you're also supposed to pick up gain, and that's the way the regime is supposed to work. This area has also been problematic. And what we've done here is we've tried to narrow the group definition, and we have two reasons for this. One was just a pure matter of policy, and the second one is a matter of avoidance issues. Usually if your policy is slightly wrong, the avoidance follows. To some extent, what you saw going back is we made a few mistakes on the policy, and when you make a mistake on policy, that is costly. So what we're doing here is we're narrowing the definition of group. A group should be one economic entity, but it also should be one entity in which all the parties involved are taxed exactly the same way. So that if sub 1 is subject to a 29% rate of tax on all of its activities, sub 2 also has to be the same way, and so is the parent. But we don't let you arbitrage with slightly different taxpayers in there. So you all have to be one economic entity, and really on the same taxpaying plane. If you don't, you start creating little problems. Now on the surface, it seems like there's no problem, but what happens if you have small weaknesses in the law, taxpayers start putting various sections together, and then they start making the big weaknesses. So what we've done here is we've said, in order to be a group, we've narrowed the definition. You've got to be a South African taxable company that's in our jurisdiction completely for policy purposes and enforcement purposes. That's what we've done. Now what that has meant is that foreign companies are falling outside the system. So for instance, if you have a foreign parent and that owns a South African sub 1 and a South African sub 2, that will no longer be a group. Because the foreign parent is not fully in our taxing jurisdiction. One, in for enforcement, and two, foreign parents were partially exempt from our system. So you can start manipulating that system and creating difficulties. And indeed, some taxpayers have done just that by turning several provisions and manipulating them together. So that's why we're narrowing this definition, and some taxpayers have complained about that, but there I think we are standing quite firm. Now, one of the comments was, if parent-owned sub 2 is trading stock, we treat sub 2 as no longer part of the group. And the banking council complained and said, well, that's not fair because we have many companies that are properties in possession. Now, this is exactly the kind of thing we didn't want as part of the group. A property in possession sub 2, say residential property or commercial building, it's not part of your group. It's sort of like your inventory. That is not part of your group, and that should not be treated as part of your group. So this is precisely the kind of thing we don't want. Because what happens is, if this is an asset you're normally going to sell, you start playing games with it. So that is not part of the group, and our position stands on that one. Another one came around with the definition of options. That if the parent and the subs are connected, but there is a contractual obligation to sell sub 2, or an option to sell sub 2, we say it's no longer part of your group because you're anticipating selling it. What taxpayers come back to us and said is this regime is a little too harsh because oftentimes we have options that we'll never really intend to exercise, or they're subject to many, many conditions. The big option being a preemptive right that says parent sub 2, parent controls sub 2, but before it can sell, it has to give somebody else an option to purchase. So parents may want to keep sub 2 forever, but before it sells, it basically allows someone else to have a right of first refusal. And taxpayers have asked for relief in those kind of circumstances. And there we have granted such relief. So to the extent that you have options where they are really of such a nature that they're contingent, that they're not really, you don't really have a buy-in at the very beginning, those kind of options will be excluded. And so we've given the taxpayers what they've wanted there. Then just a further one here is about the effective date. Let me see, I'm just going to make sure I've got this. Is on page 8. I just want to make sure my comments are to move over. Oh, okay. What we're talking about here in page 8 and 9, I just want to move it along a little bit, is the degrouping charge. If foreign parent owns sub 1 and owns sub 2, under old law, you were part of a group. Under the new rule, the definition has been narrowed, so now the group breaks up because the foreign parent doesn't count anymore. And there's a lot of issues around that because they say, look, let's say sub 1 sells assets to sub 2 transaction. And now at the time they were part of a group and now we're degrouping you. They're saying that is retroactive. Now, the problem is we're degrouping you going forward, not going back. But taxpayers need time to restructure these kind of things. And the question is, well, how do we deal with this? Now, a lot of taxpayers have asked us, let's maintain two sets of group rules. We'll have one set of group rules for the past, and we'll have one set of group rules going forward. Again, there has to be a point of hard cutoff. And so what we've done here is we said, no, we've got to go to one group definition here. We can't administer all these things. But what we've done is we've granted a more delay. So we would have a degrouping charge. In July, we were going to trigger this new rule. We're now going to just trigger it next January 2009. So we're giving people an additional 6 months to restructure. And so theoretically, they should be able to restructure here. And a lot of the restructuring is not as complicated as they say. Maybe a taxpayer can come forward and show us that. But so we are giving some relief here going forward on that. The other ones that are around that are some smaller issues. One of the issues also is around the cessation. Now, one of the things that we did is there was a trade-off here. And the trade-off was that you're going to have a narrow group definition, but there was something called a degrouping charge. Under current law, if you degroup 30 years into the future, we trigger a degrouping charge. The benefit of the new situation going forward is taxpayers will have a narrower definition. But if they keep themselves together as a group after 6 years, they won't have a degrouping charge anymore. So there's a quid pro quo in the initial legislation. What taxpayers ask for is, the stuff that hurts us, please delay forever. The stuff that helps us, please give it to us yesterday. That's usual request, right? You know, nothing surprising about that. What we've said here is, look, if you want the narrow group definition, that will be January 2009. But the benefit of the degrouping charge that we're proposing will also be January 2009. So you want the good and the bad, it goes together. And so that's really what we've done here. Just some small issue, and I'll wrap it up on this one, is the other issue is that there's a problem with the degrouping charge. And the taxpayer said, we made a fix, and they said it still doesn't work. So we've withdrawn the amendment on the degrouping charge. We have a current degrouping charge that doesn't work right under current law, and we're going to have to revisit this next year as to what is the proper degrouping charge. All we're trying to do is make sure that there's no double tax, but it gets a little complicated. So taxpayers had a problem with our new rule. It didn't work. We concede the new rule doesn't work. It's been withdrawn, and we will come back with a little more consultation time and get that one cleaned up. Then to just turn it over to Franz, just before I do that, I just want to mention one more, and that is on page 10, company reorganization. As I said, one of the things that we've done in this legislation is we've eliminated something called the financial instrument holding company test. We said that company reorganizations will be given tax benefits as long as they're not mostly filled with financial instruments. As we said originally in September, this legislation was flawed, this anti-avoidance legislation. It didn't pick up what we wanted, it created a lot of difficulty, and that we've withdrawn basically the anti-avoidance rules for financial instrument holding companies. What taxpayers have said is, look, we hated this legislation, please help us retroactively. And again, we've accommodated the taxpayers here a little bit, and we've said that this new rule is going to go into effect, I think it's January 1, I think we have it down here, it's actually gone back a little further. So what we've responded to is that for years of assessment ending on or after 30 October, that's what we have on page 11, but really we're going back further. We're going to say for all transactions 1 January 2001, 2007. So from the relief that we're giving, 1 January 2007 forward, they will get rid of this anti-avoidance rule that's concerned them for so long. So there we help the taxpayer on that one. Anyway, let me turn it over on 2.4 to Franz. Let's see here. Just make sure. Is that... Okay, hold on. Just trying to... 2.3. Okay, he's just trying to keep the tabs on me. That's fine. Okay, let's go to the... This one. 12. Okay, we'll struggle with you just a little bit more. There has been some issues around the top of page 12, and that is sale repurchase rules. What we've done is we've granted relief again here for the taxpayers, and they want more relief. It's always the way it works, right? We do something they don't like, then we have to narrow it. If we do something they like, then they want more of it. So that's kind of the way things work. Fair enough. One of the things that we did is we said, if you are under a court order and you're forced to sell your share, and you sell those shares, but you really like the company, and you want to buy back new shares, which are basically identical, then we're going to let you have rollover relief. So say I have Anglo shares, not Anglo, it's not a good example. Let me just say that I have Sappi shares, and the court order forces me to sell those Sappi shares because they're doing the restructuring or what have you, and then I want to go back and rebuy more of those shares. If I'm buying shares in the same class, you say, let all the gain roll over. We won't tax you. Whatever you had to do, you dig for somebody else, and we won't tax you. What taxpayers have asked for is that be expanded. They want it expanded to creditors. Creditors who give up their debt, and then they get shares. They said we should get relief there. And we said no to that, because it's one thing if you have shares, you sell them and buy the same shares again. You haven't cashed out. But if you start with debt and you end up with shares, you've transformed your investment. So you've asked for a little more than we're looking for. So, no. Another one that they were looking for is what about, let's see, I'm trying to get which ones they've asked for. I'm just trying to make sure. The other one is about unlisted companies. There was one request that said, well, you've only given this for listed company situations, why not unlisted? Well, I think the reason why we limited it is having canvassed a number of taxpayers. This transaction we're talking about is fairly rare, and it's only occurred in the listed context. So we granted relief where we thought it was realistic. Outside of the listed context, it just didn't typically occur. We're not even sure if it ever occurred. So we said, unless the taxpayer can come forward to us and show us what the real deal is, some hypothetical transaction somewhere, we're not going to accommodate the legislation. And to some extent, there's also issues between us and taxpayers. We try to accommodate what's really happening out there. To some extent, you don't want to start catering for hypotheticals that may or may not occur, and one of our worries is that there's more likelihood of avoidance with unlisted. So if the taxpayers come back and they can prove their case, fine, but just mere assertions is not enough. Then the other one, to close on the bottom of 12, is dealing with something called 24B, which again, I didn't have a slide for, we've seen it before. This is a very complex set of transactions, again. I've tortured you through this a number of times, and unfortunately, I seem to keep having to do that. But some companies have very interesting forms of self-financing, and there are reasons why people do this, and it's actually fairly common throughout the world. One of the difficulties that you have is getting bank financing. Our banks are very conservative, and you'll find that typically that countries that have, you know, developed countries have a problem. The banks can be very stoic. They can be stoic around the world, and getting financing for equity is hard. If you want the bank to borrow money for real estate, that isn't very much work. If you can go to any real estate seminar, they will tell you how easy it is to get borrowing for real estate. And the banks will do that because they have a hard building. So they know the moment you can't pay, they can take the building, and that's fine. But if the bank has to lend you money for your business, well, what are they going to get? They're going to get your ideas, and they're going to get your employees. Not the bank's getting a little worse. So oftentimes, when you want to buy a company and get into a company, getting that bank financing is very difficult. And one of the areas where it becomes extremely difficult is the cases where we're doing our charters and for restructuring. And unfortunately, due to our history, the people we want to help don't have the cash on hand. And there's reasons they don't have the cash on hand. And so how do we get them in the system? Well, the banks say, well, these people are credit risk. Well, there's a reason why we've got people into this situation, and we've got to get them out of that. Well, the banks don't really care. So how do you deal with this? And what you typically do is do self-financing. So the company will, instead of going to the bank and allowing somebody to buy in, they self-finance. And they say, we will issue shares to the acquiring company, who is the empowerment partners, and the empowerment partners will issue shares in return. And if the deal doesn't work, the deal will unwind. So there's some protection that goes on in these deals. And so that's the way of bringing things on in the future. Now, the two parties to the transaction, the operating company, typically a mining company is the most obvious example, but it's across the spectrum of the economy. They are the operating company. They are the company with the assets, and they are the company that's had the history of the benefits. They are effectively lending the shares to the empowerment partners. The empowerment partners are bringing to the table their future value to the company. And what we've done in the transaction here is we've said to the extent the company has lent the shares and they're getting back the value that they've lent, we will not tax them on that. The question is the other side to the transaction. Now, there we have not granted relief because the other side of the transaction is the service and the benefit provided. Those people are adding value, and that value is really salary. So it should be taxed in full. We all have to pay tax on salary. It's unfortunate, personally as well as you, but we all have to pay. And so that's what we're doing here in the request for relief around that. And you'll see later on, this is a big issue. Not just here, but more importantly, around something called 8C, where you see a lot of executive packages where people are trying to disguise their salaries in shares. Because, you know, one of the benefits is, and I just close on this, is that you and I have a problem. We earn our money in cash. And therefore, we are taxed because it is easy. The more money you have, the more flexibility you have. And the more people you have to help you. And if you're a top executive, and you make multi-millions, well, you don't need all the cash in hand. Groceries is not much of a concern to you. So you start taking the money out in shares. And then you try to make sure that those shares are never taxed. And that's what they're looking for. And what we're talking about at stake in 24B is a very similar concept. But if you take out your salary and shares, you've got to be taxed as if you got any cash. And that's really what we're getting down to. Okay? Now can I do it?
There you go.
Now you get a break from the American accent. All right. Section 9C. This is the so-called safe harbor rule for shares. At the moment, what we have is a rule that says if you've got listed shares and you hold them for more than 5 years, you can take the option of treating them as being on capital account. Now, what we're doing is we're changing that here, and we're saying that that now reduces to 3 years and it extends to a much broader range of shares. Obviously, now, one of the issues that will come up is, well, why can't we extend it to all shares across the board? And we've had some exclusions, and we'll touch on that now briefly. The first comment you'll see there on page 13 refers to what happens if I don't qualify for this three-year rule. Well, that's exactly as it is today if you don't qualify for the five-year rule. The normal rules apply. It's actually a little difficult to say that, you know, if this rule doesn't apply, then all the other rules in the Act apply, because that should go without saying. And that's really the response here, but we'll clarify that yet again in the explanatory memorandum just to make sure that that point does come across. That is actually a very important point, because some people, almost at the back of their mind, seem to have this thought that if it doesn't qualify for the three-year rule, it will automatically then be on revenue accounts. That is not the case. Okay? And once you appreciate that fact, the fact that certain kinds of assets are excluded, or share are excluded from the three-year rule, then simply means the ordinary rules apply and it is not a disaster. Now, on to the second comment. Well, this is, and in fact, the third, is that there are certain exclusions, and one of them is offshore unlisted shares. And the request there is, well, can't we extend it to that? Our answer simply there is no. There are special rules in that area already, and the way the various rules would interact would require far more work before we'd be prepared to even think about moving into that area. Of course, we also have certain concerns about some of the transactions that happen in the offshore arena, which then just adds a little bit of spice to the problem. Similarly, for comment three, can we extend it to preference shares? Now, here there's an interesting dichotomy in the comments we've been getting. On the one hand, people have said when we were talking about the share capital allocation rules and the share premium allocation rules that preference share values do not change much. Here, however, we're saying, please can we treat any capital gains or any gains we make from the disposals of the preference shares as being on capital account if they meet the three-year rule. There seems to be a little tension between those two sets of comments, because really, you shouldn't need this rule if the preference share values are as stable as you're telling us they are in other comments. Comment number four says, can we please not exclude certain kinds of group relief here? And the answer is no, we must exclude them. And the answer to why we must exclude them is to prevent people using the group rules to turn other kinds of assets into assets that would qualify for a three-year automatic rule. So essentially, we need that exclusion in order to stop people gaming the system. Comment number five talks to, well, what happens if my shares split? I used to have 100 shares, but these shares got so expensive that the company decided, well, you know, we'll have a 10-for-1 split, and now you have 1,000 shares. What was the value? What is the time? When did I get those shares? That the rules were currently silent as to that, we'll put in a provision that basically says where that happens, it's the original date. Because remember, it's the date that's important here. Have you held this for 3 years or more? Comment number six is another comment that says, back in the five-year rule days, there was a fairly extended period where you could get away with swapping land for shares and then qualifying for the relief, the five-year relief on the disposal of those shares. So that's precisely what we just said under comment one number four, we don't want to see. We closed that down for 2 years, and then that whole regime fell away. So we had an extended period where you were allowed to do this, then a short period where you weren't. The three-year rule, as originally drafted, said you don't qualify. So we followed the two-year part. This is an instance now where we've changed and we're saying, okay, we will allow you to do that. It's a historical situation that you find yourself in. We will allow you to qualify for the three-year rule because essentially most people would have anyway under the old five-year rule. It's just a very short period when they would not have. And then this is a particular case where a hard cut-off helps taxpayers. Okay, we had two options. We could have tried to run two systems continuing into the future. We said, no, we want one system running into the future. And in this particular case, it advantages taxpayers. Comment number seven says, well, haven't you got a bit of a conflict in these rules? Because in the three-year rule, what we say is you sell your oldest shares first. But what if I've adopted another valuation system for other parts of the Income Tax Act? Okay, weighted average. Well, the answer is precisely in that problem formulation. The one deals with how long you held the shares. The other deals with how you value the shares. Okay? And they're different. You can't have a weighted average length of time for which you've held a share. We've tried that. It gives you some very strange results because we've had this problem elsewhere. So we have simply said, and it's the existing five-year rule, if you have shares, you're deemed to have sold the oldest ones first. And really, taxpayers should love that as a concept because if you're selling your oldest shares first, the odds are you're going to qualify for the three-year rule more easily than if you were told that you were selling your most recent shares first. So that's the fairly significant change that we have here that would assist taxpayers with certainty with respect to their shareholdings in unlisted and very... My mic kicked out here. Alright. Intellectual cross-border payments. We've gone through the issues here, which is simply that what we are seeing as transactions where intellectual property developed in South Africa is being expatriated, moved offshore, and we're seeing revenue streams being taken out of South Africa now for the use of that property that was developed here. Now, there are several changes that were then proposed to close this down. One was a slightly lower standard for what a connected person would be so that we could apply the transfer pricing rules. The comment was that instead of just limiting this to intellectual property, we seem to have done it across the board. I would accept that comment. We will ensure that that limitation occurs. That sort of flows through into comment number two as well. And we then move on to page 16, which talks about the kind of transaction I've just described, where you've got this intellectual property that you expatriate. The first point is, well, you know, exchange control has done the job for you, so why do you need to worry about it now? Well, exchange control has gone through several phases. It's been tougher and more relaxed over time, so it has not been an entirely consistent measure here. And the other point to be made here is that there are a lot of calls for exchange control to be relaxed. So to say that you would like to rely on something that I promise I'm not touching it. All right. So essentially, you've seen this in the past as well. As exchange controls have been relaxed over time, so the tax system has had to step into the breach. Where there are risks. And you've seen that when people were allowed to start moving funds offshore in the individual capacities, we had to move to expand the tax base. So equally, if we are to proceed on the basis of relaxing exchange control, you can't then rely on exchange control to act as your protection. Again, Comment number two is the retrospective argument. We transferred this property some years ago. Now we're going to have a limitation placed on our deductions going forward. If I could sort of touch on a very down-to-earth analogy here. If I sign an employment contract with my employer and the Minister of Finances reduces individual tax rate next year, does that mean I don't qualify because I signed a contract this year? I mean, we have a set of expenditures for services or goods that are going into the future, and we're changing how the deductions in respect of payments in the future are going to be treated. Similarly with my employment contract, fortunately, the fact that I signed it last year doesn't mean that I don't get to miss out on the tax benefits that subsequently follow. Comment number three, there are several legs to the disallowance. The one relates to if it was developed in South Africa by yourself or a connected person. The other, the first one in fact, and the one that's being complained of here, is that if this intellectual property was ever owned by a South African, the denial takes place. And the answer, the question here is, well, how do? And the answer to that is that intellectual property is registered, so you can go and look it up. The proposed comment number four says, well, your provision goes a bit too broadly because it says that if any part of this intellectual property that you're now using was developed in South Africa, your whole deduction is lost. And there are little tweaks that you may make to the intellectual property that would then be minor and would disqualify you. We accept that. And you'll see we're introducing a wholly or mainly test here for the intellectual property or material part thereof. So here what we're doing is we're saying, okay, there's a little tweak to it that doesn't disqualify you. But if you have made a substantial contribution to it, there is a...
And then the final one.
In comment number five, deals with the ability to claim a one-third deduction if the withholding tax on the royalty that has been paid offshore has been levied. Essentially, there's a question here of what happens if a double taxation agreement reduces that 12% that is levied? Do I still get the one-third? And the answer is yes, as long as it doesn't reduce it below 10%. If it's reduced below 10%, then you don't get the deduction. So that's a clarification for taxpayer benefit. Back to Keith.
Okay, just one general note on that intellectual property, because there has been some newspaper discussions on that, and I think everything Franz says I completely agree with. One of the things that's been called just an emotional argument on this is that a lot of people said, well, if you do this, we're not going to be a competitive intellectual property center anymore. That's the issue that's gotten in the newspaper, and that's been sort of raised in a couple of comments in a very general way. The anti-avoidance rule that we're talking about, this 23i, is really to stop something that's really abusive. And that is, you develop it here, you take it off to a tax haven, and then you charge us excessively for it. And when you charge us excessively for it, 30 years into the future, any profits you make from the company are basically eliminated because you're charging us, South Africa, for intellectual property you created here. Now, they say, well, surely we should allow that because it'll make us very competitive. What they're really saying is, we will only be competitive as a country if you allow us to if you allow us to get ripped off. So if we let you rip us off, that's great, we're competitive. But the moment we don't do that, well, then we're not competitive. Now, there comes a point, we want to be competitive, we want to help out taxpayers, but there is a point where just ripping us off, well, I don't see it. Now, the key to this transaction, though, in this area, is we do need to be careful. This is an elephant gun area. We're trying to make sure we hit the really abusive transaction. So on the one hand, we remain firm in our position. However, the number of taxpayers who come forward who raise some of these issues and who have communicated with us these specific transactions, we are trying to look at to see if those are the kind of things we want to hit. And so we've seen one transaction last week that they had a problem, and I think we've solved that problem.
I hope we did. I know we've tried to solve it in the version of legislation. And they were concerned about a double tax situation, and I think we've removed that. It was never intended. Earlier this week, we met with two other sets of taxpayers raising other issues. And one of the issues, I think they just didn't understand the law that we're clarifying the explanatory memorandum. Another issue that we've raised, we're researching. And a third one that has come back, and it was one of the taxpayers that commented, was they had also a situation where they were looking for assistance. In their situation, what was going on is the intellectual property was generated offshore. It was created offshore, but operating here, they were branding it here. So they were adding some value to it to market it here. And they're saying, look, that's not what you're really going for. The intellectual property is initiated offshore. You're just embellishing it here. You don't want to go after that. And so we said, come back with the facts on that, and we will also try to accommodate. So the key around is a little bit, there is some wording issues around here. And to the extent that taxpayers have concerns and legitimate transactions that are not representing a ripoff, we will accommodate. But we will not respond to emotional arguments here. And so to the extent that taxpayers have gone forward in the facts, we have assistance. The problem is the words. We know what we're going after. We're going after situations where you develop it here and you take it offshore. But the English language is only so effective, and intellectual property is a very loose thing. So we try to draft it as best we can, but we are open to some changes as we see the facts. And so I think right now the parties who have the biggest concerns, we are dealing with them, and their transactions are not the kind of things that we wanted to hit. So I just wanted to close on that point. Okay, just issues, this won't take too long, on long-term insurers now. This is page 17. 2.6. The first comment, comment one. And what you have here is there were comments here actually by the Banking Association in South Africa, and also I think Old Mutual also commented here just for your clarification on page 17. The first set of comments was, what happened is this. If a CFC has linked policies, you know, if you buy an RA, you have a linked policy, and you own it through your insurance company. The insurance company has various investment schemes. And what happened was, is the insurance company structure, something called the four funds approach, is a very unique system, and in some ways it works very well. The problem is when you have a very unique system mixing with other systems, it's sort of like the sweet and the sour in the soup. It doesn't quite go together very well. And the life insurance industry is a very unique system of taxation that often doesn't mix well with the rest of the system. And what we're trying to do in the initial amendment was to make sure that if you invest through a life insurance company, that it's treated no better or worse than if you directly invested through a collective investment scheme. What happened was, is that if you invested in an offshore collective investment scheme, you were punished if you used the life insurer. And so we went to solve that, and the insurance company are happy with that. Then they said, okay, well, we're glad with that, and then they wanted one more request. And they said, well, the way it works is, we have a situation where a life insurer, and we own our own policies, and we also own policies on behalf of trustees. Now, you pulled out the trustees, but we, our own policies that we own directly, sometimes can be indirectly affected by other parties. And we want relief for our policies and our holdings if other things happen outside our control. And what they're basically asking for is more relief than other people are getting. Sometimes when you hold an offshore subsidiary, you are taxed if South Africans control it, even though you don't control it. But if South Africans as a group control it, we tax you. Now, sometimes that control changes, where the control will go in, out, in, out. And we're saying is, to the extent that South Africans are in control, you bear the full brunt of the tax. If there's an in-out situation, you have to live with that. And so the life insurance company. So that's what that one is about on comment one. Comment two is, well, you've given it to the insurers. Why don't you give it to the banks and to some other people as well? Because, you know, we've got to compete. The difference, though, is the banks and these other financial institutions are not subject to the four funds approach. They have a different world, and they don't get the benefits or the burdens of the four funds approach.
So here's a case they don't get the benefit because they're not getting the burden, and so that comment is not accepted. So basically, original legislation stands as is, but this is legislation, again, designed to help the taxpayer to make sure that if you invest in a life insurance company and you have an offshore investment, that you're not treated any worse than if you invested directly. So the original legislation stands. Turning now to 2.7 depreciation. There was a number of depreciation regimes, and basically we're helping the taxpayers here in a number of senses. And basically the request is, well, can we have some more? Now, we have basically three sets of depreciation relief rules that we're adding. One is for commercial buildings, one is for ports and trains, and another one is for environmental equipment. The first one was for commercial buildings on page 18, and comment one says, you've given us relief for the new and unused buildings. What about the old buildings? We want that relief as well. Now, it sounds like a reasonable question. Why, if I buy an old building, shouldn't I get it? Well, we've taken a policy for the last number of years that we're really trying to incentivize is new construction. And so what we've done is we've said, no, we don't extend it to the old buildings because what you're going to have is a deadweight loss. It's going to be an enormous cost to the fiscus to say, okay, if you have an old building and you want to move that around now, you can basically get the depreciation for that. I don't know how much commercial property you have in South Africa, but all of a sudden we will now have huge deductions for stuff that we're not adding any value. Now, you can do that as a relief. There's some arguments to be said, but you're going to have to pay a substantial amount of money for that. Now, is that a budget priority or not a budget priority? I think the budget priority is the new buildings, not just giving incentives for old, but it's an issue that we can come back to at a later date. One thing that was pointed out in the comments is, what if I have an old building and I do a new improvement? Surely the new improvement should be assisted. And I think there, that's correct. We just, actually, that's what we always intended. We just made a mistake in what we drafted there. So I would take responsibility for that. So new buildings and new improvements. But to the extent you want old and unused, well, now we're into a different game altogether. So that is, those are comments basically in one and two. Comment 3 on page 19 deals with effective dates again. You'll always see this. Again, you'll be sick of this by the time we're done. And it's, well, you made this legislation effective going forward, but when the minister made an announcement on 21 Feb and I went out to go get that building, I expected to get the new relief. I think that argument is a little overstated personally, because we hadn't put it into law, we hadn't really described it too well. These people are what we call big boys. They know that the law is the law. A minister announcement as to the date is something else, but we decided to be generous anyway. So to the extent that you built this new, you entered into a contract after 21 Feb, and you built the building afterward, or you began construction afterward, you'll get the incentive. So 1 April, I'm sorry, I got the dates, I'm just going back and forth on the debate. So it's 1 April because that's consistent with the company financial year. So 1 April going forward, and that was the request in the comment that was made, and a few others, and so we've made a concession there. Another issue is around port assets. There have been two sets of rules around these port assets. Again, you're helping us, so we want the relief sooner, and two, we want more of it. You know, so really all it is. I mean, debate after debate, if we do something good, they want more, they want it sooner. If we do something bad, they want less, they want it later, and we argue about this, and then we do this for the next 30 years of our lives, so we'll just carry on. In the case of ports, what the question was is, well, you cover ports for transport, like berths and all seawalls, I don't know how much stuff I learned about ports, but why don't you cover off-dock container depots, where basically that's a piece of concrete where you put the containers on. And I think there we said, yes, we will give the relief to off-dock container depots, and so that was fine. The other one was, why not marinas and fishing harbors? Now we want that as well. Now, I'm not saying we have any objection to marinas and fishing harbors, but the research that we did was around the shipping transport industry and what we were doing and why. And what we were really trying to do with rail and transport was we were trying to improve productivity. If you take a look at the research that was done, is that a lot of times South Africa gets criticized in the newspapers for being unproductive. You'll see the newspaper ad, unproductive South Africa. So you have these images of people
taking a snooze and nobody's working and, you know, that's how we are. But if you take a look at the numbers, the unproductivity isn't because people lack energy. A lot of the unproductivity is because we have an inefficient transport system, and we also have a problem in our geography. This is an African problem. If you're fortunate as a country, all of your port, your cities are on the coast, or they're right next to a river. That makes you much more productive, because when you transfer goods around, it's a lot easier. So London has a great advantage. It always did. That's why they had a benefit. The difficulty that Africa has is that many of the cities are built around mining or around resources. And so they're not built on the ports. So, for instance, Johannesburg is great because it was built around diamonds and gold and all those things. And Pretoria is the same way. But it's not next to any coast. So it runs, you have to then take the goods and ship them to Durban, and there's a whole cost that goes along with this, and this makes you less productive. And that's because the cities that were chosen were not chosen by South Africans, in a sense. They were chosen by the colonists. So you had a situation where that productivity is a problem. And what we were trying to do was we're trying to promote transport infrastructure to produce, improve the productivity. The main one is around the rails and the roads, you'll see. But again, what we're also talking about is our ports. Fishing and marinas, well, that's nice, isn't the research we've done. So what we're saying is we can come back to this issue, but we need to do our homework first. Just because it sounds similar in law doesn't mean it sounds is actually similar in commercial respect. So again, that one we will come back to, but at this stage I think we need to just do a little bit more of our homework on that. Let's see here. Is there anything else? Okay, there was one other one that's a little funny on page 20, which we're still dealing with a little bit, and that is, okay, again, effective dates. What was suggested was that the relief is given to port assets that are brought into use as of 1 January 2008. So they might have contracted for in 2007, 2006, but if it's brought into use in 2008, they now want it. Now, we've been fairly generous in this one because we're trying to encourage infrastructure. We think it's very important in the port area. So the brought into use concept will be allowed, and that is what the taxpayers were requesting. The only issue is what does brought into use mean? If I have a seawall and it's holding back the waters, did it get brought into use the moment I built it or the moment the port got going? And I think what we're trying to say is it's once the port gets going. But this is the kind of legal silliness that we have to deal with here. And either we deal with it in the EM or the law itself, I think we're still quibbling how to help them there. But it's just a matter of clarity. So that's an issue in port assets. On page 20 now, environment, there were questions around what we've done there. Now, the environmental rule, again, what happens is under current law, a lot of environmental assets do get depreciation relief. A lot of them don't. Why the difference? Well, because we haven't thought about it. Tax laws are really a 1940s, 1950 creation. At that time, environment was not an issue. You could do whatever you wanted to the environment. So the law wasn't really designed around that. And so some environmental equipment was getting a 40-20-20 relief. Some things were getting zero. Some were getting five. Who knew what was going on? You just had to get lucky. If you got lucky, you won. If you didn't, you lost. What we did in the new regime is to say, look, environmental assets should be given dignity that they deserve, and to the extent they are machinery and they are plant machinery, equipment of that nature, in a manufacturing sense, manufacturing gets 40-20-20, so does this. And there were some questions about the clarity of the legislation, and we've cleared that up. But one of the issues that came up is, well, if you have environmental equipment, but it is not required by law, we should still get the incentive anyway. So if we make this equipment above and beyond the law, we should also get the incentive. Now, here there's a lot of debate about this. I mean, from an emotional sense, I'm sympathetic to that. On the other hand, what you describe is what is an environmental expenditure, what you and I think is an environmental expenditure, and what a tax lawyer thinks is environmental expenditure, sometimes can be funny things. And we wanted to make sure it was required by law, so that it really was an environmental expenditure. For example, if I build a house or I build a structure that looks nice, maybe I use wood on the wall rather than stone, or I use biodegradable, or something that looks more attractive with the countryside terrain. Does that become an environmental expenditure? Well, probably not, but you know, this is an extreme case, and hopefully the legislation deals with it in other ways, but it can get quite broad, and so we've limited to that. And also, I think the issues around here are fairly emotional. The South African legislation environment is a first-rate environmental legislation. It is quite broad. It's up to date with modern standards. So I'm doubtful that any company is going to go above and beyond that standard. So maybe I'm wrong. Let them come forward. But I think the overall relief is quite generous at the end of the day. The other one was raised last time, was some equipment gets 40-20-20, some gets 5. Now the 40-20-20 is for short-lived assets. So there's a lot of equipment, you know, a lot of plants and those kind of things that don't last forever, and there it gets accelerated. The 5% is more like the waste disposal site, the cement things, the stuff that's like a building. It's a permanent structure. And so the taxpayers, the lawyers, it's funny, it's always the lawyers who now are going to tell you what depreciation is about. Again, I'm a lawyer too, so maybe I'm to blame. But they say, well, 5%, why 5%? Make it 10. That sounds reasonable. And we go, okay, yeah, why not? Well, we rejected that comment because they have no basis for their position. We don't just choose 5 and 10 because it feels good, even though it seems like that to some sometime, but I'm not going to push that too hard. But we do actually try to research these things. And so on the environmental stuff, we took some time. We met with a number of companies. We took a look at some IMF information. We had other information we got from DEET. And when you're talking about a lot of these waste disposal sites, most of the depreciation rate's really around 2.5 to 3%. Now, we gave 5 because it was just easier administratively because we have a lot of 5% rules throughout the Act, but we were being fairly generous. But there is no basis in law over 10%, even though it sounds nice. So we stick to the 5 on that one. Anyway, let me give my voice a rest, and we'll turn it over to Fran.
Okay, before we go into the exemptions on occupational death benefits, can we take some cafe and then come back and proceed? 10 minutes. Should be back here by 20 past.